It is 8:30, and we have live in the studios with us once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
How are you both today? You survived your last weekend of publication rush?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
This is our off weekend. Last weekend, we were publishing the paper.
We're sleeping it off, basically, at this point.
Very good.
Well, I'm awake.
Stay with me. 28 minutes to go.
Okay. Good morning.
So, interesting week for a lot of things, but here in Seattle, Jim Compton looks like he caught a bit of flack he wasn't expecting.
Yeah, leaving on a jet plane. poor Mr. Compton, he has all of the answers. I mean, this is a guy who, if you ever interview him or had any public dealings with him, and actually this is true for, I think, members of the general public, too, if they see him at candidate forums or whatnot, the man is incredibly arrogant. And I think it comes from many years of being, you know, a TV star and TV host, and he has this sort of avuncular uncle knows best persona that can never admit doing any wrong. Well, he had to admit wrong doing this week, because the reports have been floating around for some time that among many other things, and he's just gotten flack for this one particular incident, that Mr. Compton accepted a plane ride from Vulcan Ventures, Paul Allen's company, down to watch a basketball game in Portland with the basketball team that Paul Allen owns, on a private jet chartered by Paul Allen. Then went back and voted on development projects in South Lake Union that would directly benefit Paul Allen. You might sense a theme here of Paul Allen. And Mr. Compton has maintained for some time that there was absolutely nothing wrong with this arrangement. Well, a number of other people thought there was something wrong with this arrangement. And in fact, you know, for all the flap that's been brewing over actually dragging on over Strippergate and the willingness of Judy Nicastro and Jim Compton and Heidi Wills to accept money for a rezone of a strip club in the North End, and then, you know, the votes changed once they got caught with their hands in the till. But you know, this is the strip club in the North End is kind of like a mom and pop operation, and the lobbying for it was Al Rossellini, which is a 93-year-old former governor. He's not exactly a political heavyweight these days. Whereas Vulcan Ventures has 8 full-time lobbyists working City Hall. They have, Paul Allen basically has both ends of downtown, the directions in which downtown can expand, bookended. He managed to buy up much of South Lake Union in preparation for the Commons project, and he has much of the property around the old King Street train station in that area down by the stadiums as well. And so almost all of the votes that come before City Council that involve how to zone or how to develop or how to lay public infrastructure for this area of the city have direct financial benefit to Paul Allen's companies. And you have this remarkable series of things going on, such as, you know, city council members being trotted in to get symposiums from scientists showing all these cool biotech things that they'll be doing in the South Lake Union. And this, of course, is all stuff that, you know, Paul Allen is behind, because he's got all of the buildings there that he's trying to develop into this biotech research facility and area, and the city is laying all the fiber optic cables and all of the infrastructure that's needed for that, and also
including
some of the,
a streetcar that's
yeah,
only
the bells
going
and,
to serve the
exactly,
people who
the,
work in the neighborhood.
The bells and whistles also, such as the streetcar trolley, and you know, you've got Allen stock, you know, stacking the transportation studies that are recommending the street trolley, and you know, all of these different things going on. And so now you have Jim Compton caught with his hand in the till, and he has this press conference yesterday at which he's very contrite and admits that he has done error. And this is for a couple of reasons. One is that he has accepted the $3,000 fine from the Ethics and Election Commission, which For one thing, I wasn't aware that it was up to a public official as to whether to accept or not being fined for being in violation of the law. It's like, you know, my going to court for something or rather, and the judge tells me to go to jail for 6 months, and I decide whether to accept it or not. I mean, you know, it's that level of arrogance by Mr. Compton. But beyond that, the $3,000 fine, if you look at it, you know, if I were to charter a private jet to go to Portland and buy, you know, one of these skybox suites for a professional basketball game, the actual street value of that is probably greater than $3,000. I mean, you know, the fine that this guy is paying for this is really pretty minimal, and it's, you know, and unfortunately, it's really as much as the Ethics and Election Commission can do. You'd really have to go to the city attorney or possibly the FBI on corruption charges in order to find where this really probably should go legally. And then you have the reality that one of the reasons that Compton can cop to this is that he doesn't have any strong challengers in the primary next week, and he doesn't have, and by extension, he won't in the general election in November either.
And he has the support of the mayor and the whole downtown Seattle Business Association.
Yes, very, very much so. I mean, he's not going to face any outcry from the daily papers trying to run him out of office the way Judy Nicastro would. I mean, you can imagine the reaction of the political establishment in town if it were Nicastro that were caught doing this rather than Compton.
Exactly.
Well, the real penalty seems to be that he can't vote on South Lake Union stuff for a year.
Yes.
Well, but no, he's going to lobby. He's basically said he's just going to lobby on behalf of Vulcan.
Yeah, which you know, what does that tell you about his all the votes that he's taken in the past?
What exactly does that mean that he's going to lobby? I mean, I can imagine.
Well, he has said he's going to be a shill for the South Lake Union Development Project, and he's going to push the other council members.
And even before
reviewing some of the proposals,
not only that, but bear in mind that when a council member says he's going to do that, it's not just pat you on the back and say, Ralph, I really think you ought to vote for this. It's pat you on the back and say, Ralph, if you want that that fire department levy to pass that you were talking about, you know, I don't think I can vote for that unless you vote for my pet South Lake Union thing. That's what we're talking about when we talk about Jim Compton lobbying for this. It's not just lobbying, it's vote trading.
So that brings Vulcan's number of lobbyists up to 9 now. They have a full baseball team.
Yeah, exactly. that's very true.
Jim Compton is their star pitcher.
There you go.
He's the inside guy. Yeah.
And he's probably their best played payer. Player too.
Yeah, real good with the curveballs.
We can't say that for sure.
Yeah,
but.
Exactly. Well, we can't. No, it's probably some others that are pretty well paid too. But yeah. It really does stink to high heaven, and that's really the nicest thing that can be said about it. Here we have a guy who, and you know, I think Gene Godden is really of the same mindset in terms of the probably the strongest candidate who's running against Nicastro. You know, somebody who has spent years in media is very much part of the civic and political and cultural elite in town, talking about Compton and his years working for King and then for a little while for PBS, and who sees himself 4 years ago as running for city council basically the same way some other people would join the Lions or the Kiwanis. This is his public service. This is giving back to the city and a way of guarding the gates of the city establishment against the barbarian hordes, the, you know, the would-be Charlie Chongs of the world. Yeah, exactly. You and I. And, you know, and he's been doing that. He's you know, guarding the interests of the rich and powerful. And we're seeing that now with his saying that he's going to shill for Vulcan.
All right. Well, speaking of the rich and powerful, one of their lead organizations is meeting down in Cancun this
yeah,
week.
Yeah, there's the World Trade Organization.
Nice transition, by the way.
Thank you.
The World Trade Organization is meeting in Cancun this week in Mexico, in the Mexico resort town of Cancun. Now, we talked about...
The island, by the way.
The island, yes.
Easily defended.
Yes. and they have pretty much closed off the whole area from the rest of Mexico. It's very, very difficult for people to get in and out unless they have the official pass as a delegate. Now, what's going on down there and why it's important, I just want to talk about that for a minute. The WTO is basically... as folks know, World Trade Organization, they exist to break down trade barriers on behalf of the developed world, the U.S. and Europe, and to the detriment of poorer nations in the world. And the way the WTO was originally set up, most nations in the world, most particularly most poor nations in the world, didn't really have a say in what the WTO was going to do, how it was going to be set up, and what these various agreements that come out of the ministerial meetings would be about and what they would do. Right now, they're talking about agricultural subsidies and world trade in agricultural products. That's the big issue this year with the WTO. Now, the Seattle Round, if you'll remember, about 4 years ago in 1999, the Seattle Round was historic because it was a wash-up for this, the way the WTO had originally been set up and intended to benefit the rich nations of the world. What happened, and I just want everybody who is listening today, who was out in the street in November and December of 1999, I want you to just pat yourself on the back because you're largely responsible for this. What happened during the Seattle Round is that the poorer nations of the world, whose delegates were sitting in on that meeting, saw all of the people, the thousands of people who were in the streets of Seattle blockading the entrance to the Paramount Theater and other venues where WTO delegates were meeting, including some of the hotels where people like Madeleine Albright were staying, and they couldn't get out of the hotel even to get to the meetings.
And we can only hope it took a couple of years off her life.
That's right.
The blood pressure and all that.
Yeah, and the delegates saw this and they said, maybe we can do the same thing. Maybe we delegates of the poorer nations of the world can get together, and if we hold the line and say no to some of this stuff, we can stop the United States and Europe from extracting our resources and then dumping cheap goods in our markets and destroying our farmers and destroying a lot of our homegrown markets.
And bearing in mind, this is in context, many of these countries had similar types of demonstrations and political pressures back home, and they simply hadn't been able to find any kind of political traction by which they could stand up to the North on this.
That's right. And a good example of that is in India, where farmers have, and many other groups as well, have protested against their government for letting down barriers and making these really horrible trade agreements with the West and through the WTO that have harmed their local markets. So what you have now is we had the Seattle Round, where a group of African nations got together and started it all and said, no, we do not want to go along with the program. And other nations like India and Brazil and Argentina and China now have gotten in on the act. The last ministerial was 2 years ago in Qatar, and not much progress was made there. And then this is the current ministerial now in Mexico. Mexico was kind of an interesting choice because in Mexico you have farmers who are really, really suffering from cheap imported corn from the United States. Why this is a problem is that third world countries are not supposed to have any trade barriers against the large amounts of U.S. food and European food that are dumped in their nations. However, here in the U.S., large corporate agribusiness concerns are supported by price supports and subsidies from the U.S. government. And those price supports and subsidies, like last year's, I believe it was $100 million.
The Farm Bill.
Farm Bill. Most of those price supports go to the very, very largest agribusinesses in America and by extension in the world, too. Now, how this harms Mexican farmers and Indian farmers and farmers in Brazil and all over the world is that when our government pays farmers to grow corn, they don't have to necessarily get such a high price on the market if they're getting money also from the government to keep them in business. For example, the U.S. U.S. farmers produce about twice the amount of wheat that Americans can eat, and so there's tons and tons and tons of wheat that are left over, excess wheat, excess corn, etc. That gets bought up by the government, and what that does is that means those farmers get a higher price for their food than they would if they had to sell it on the open market, where there would be this huge excess and the price would drop. So it's an artificial price support. That's what a price support is. Well, then the U.S. government has to do something with that excess food. And what does it usually do? Well, it usually takes that food and puts it into its aid programs as food aid to places like Ethiopia, for example, is the current really bad example. Ethiopia is going through a famine, but it is not as bad as famines in prior years because a portion of the country has been able to grow its own food. And those Ethiopian farmers had thought that they would be able to sell that food or at least have their own government buy it up to feed it their own poor people who weren't able to feed themselves. However, Ethiopian farmers have had to store their wheat. They've had to put it into storage because imported U.S. food aid has dropped the price of wheat so low in Ethiopia that Ethiopian farmers cannot make a living by selling their wheat in their own country to feed their own starving people. That's an example of how U.S. food aid and U.S. price supports and U.S. subsidies to these large agribusiness companies harm third world countries. Now, the U.S. also uses food in another way, not just by supporting large agribusinesses by buying up excess wheat. It can use some of this wheat and some of this corn, for example, as political tools. In 1999, the Clinton administration used excess wheat, they took some of that excess wheat and delivered it to Russia in the form of food aid. And they did this not just because Russia needed the food aid, but because the European Union was trying to sell wheat into Russia at the same time. And it had the effect of dropping the price of wheat in Russia so low that the European Union essentially lost that market for its agricultural produce. So the U.S. government often uses food as a political and economic tool in a way that is, I believe, very despicable.
Well, and not only that, but it's a way that's directly counter to the trade regulations of the World Trade Organization. And the WTO, like many other international institutions, the United States has been treating routinely as one rule for us, different rules for everybody else. And this is where a lot of the tension is coming from.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so 21 countries have united at this ministerial meeting in Cancun and formed a group that is fighting the European Union and the U.S. to drop these subsidies for their farmers, particularly for their large agribusiness concerns. Now, some of those countries include Brazil, China, Argentina, Egypt, India, and in total, they represent more than half of the world's population and more than two-thirds of the world's farmers. Now, the U.S. delegates and the European Union delegates have been treating them pretty shabbily, but they also have not been able to make much progress in getting an agricultural agreement to move forward because of this group of 21 nations. And that's what's happening down in Cancun right now, pretty much a deadlock. I think if they don't come out with an agricultural agreement in this ministerial, I think it's pretty clear that the WTO is suffering and may actually eventually collapse.
Yeah, I think the WTO actually, I don't think it will collapse. I think it will become irrelevant, and the United States has been positioning
it's
itself.
Pretty much the same.
Yeah, but it has been positioning itself with a number of these sort of multilateral regional agreements to try and supplant the WTO, because you can imagine the political fallout if the Bush administration or any administration was presented with this ultimatum, you know, stop your domestic support for your farmers. It's like, you know, what right does the rest of the world have to tell us what to do with, you know, our domestic yada, yada, yada? Well, this is what the United States routinely does to the domestic, you know, economic and social programs of every other country in the world. But, you know, you can imagine, you know, Republicans and conservatives going off about, you know, impinging on the sovereignty of America and all the rest of this were it to happen here. So it's not going to happen. It's not something that the United States is going to give in on. And, you know, I think they will watch the WTO collapse rather than try to give credence to any of these arguments.
Yes, I think so.
And, excuse me, and did you hear about the Korean farmer who committed suicide?
Yes, there was a large demonstration of Korean farmers on the first day of the ministerial outside the enormous fence that barricades off Cancun from the rest of Mexico. One activist in that group, a prominent activist in that group, climbed up on the fence holding a sign that says WTO kills farmers and waved it around for a bit, and then he dropped the sign and stabbed himself in the chest as a protest. And now, people need to understand that farmers all over the world, so many of them are in such deep debt that it's common for farmers to commit suicide, to give up their land, to move to cities and take poverty-level jobs or live as beggars. This is very, very common. It's been very common in the last 20 years.
It's something that Vandana Shiva, for example, talks about in India quite a bit, that the suicide rate among farmers there has been enormous in the last 20 years as a result. So it's really just making visible a trend that has happened in the quiet and solitude of small towns around the third world for many years.
And it shocks me that this was not a much more major headline or news story, that this man actually did this in front of the WTO.
All right, moving along. This week in Iraq, a lot of developments.
Yeah, I want to start it with just by saying that another car bomb exploded in northern Iraq. This is the fifth car bomb in 5 weeks. This also didn't make the news much. It was in the Kurdish city of Erbil, the largest city in northern Iraq. The building that was destroyed was in a residential area. It was being used by U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency personnel. Three Iraqis were killed and six American intelligence agents were severely injured. The blast demolished several houses nearby in the residential neighborhood. And I just want to point out that this is the first time an attack of this kind has happened in northern Iraq, in the Kurdish region, which has been considered very, very peaceful until now. Now, the New York Times reported this week, speaking of bombs and munitions and so forth, that about 50 munition sites in Iraq that contain such bombs and munitions that have been used in these car bomb attacks are very poorly guarded or only have very light security. They said that there are 2,700 munition sites in Iraq in total, and certainly not enough U.S. troops to guard them all or experts to destroy the contents. Last month, American officials escorted by U.S. troops visited some of these sites, including a former Iraqi Air Force base near Baghdad and a storage area north of the capital. Neither site had any visible security at all. At the airbase,
so you could just walk right in and help yourself.
Yeah. For example, at the airbase, there were no guards and no security gate, and local villagers were busy looting the site as the Americans drove up. The airbase had piles of live shells and a wide variety of bombs and mines. At other sites that the Americans visited, Iraqi guards were charged by the local villagers as having taken payments to allow looters in to just rummage through and take whatever they wanted.
I understand U-Stored is going to take over those facilities.
or Halliburton. I think they're actually getting all of the contracts there, but yeah.
Now, speaking of munitions, some of these munitions have been used to blow up the oil export pipelines. One was blown up again about a week and a half ago. That's the main export pipeline from the northern city of Kirkuk, the northern fields, to Turkey.
And this, once again, is the main way that the United States has in the past proposed that it's going to pay for the staggering cost of the reconstruction and occupation of Iraq.
Yeah, it will now take at least 5 weeks for that pipeline to open, and when it opens, we can probably expect yet another bombing.
Or about 2 days before it opens, actually.
That's right. Yeah. And again, last week, I just want to point out that the Bush administration asked Congress for $87 billion. So they are trying to sell this plan as a way to rebuild Iraq. However, I want to point out that three-quarters of that money is for the military occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. Of the remaining funds, which are supposed to be for reconstruction, another $5 billion will be used to train Iraqi police, militia, and army recruits to help with the occupation. Now, that's going to be a tough job, especially since about a day or two ago, U.S. soldiers opened fire on Iraqi police and killed about nine Iraqi police and one Jordanian security guard. Now, these friendly fire incidents are becoming more common, particularly since the U.S. has a policy of shoot first and ask questions later, and particularly when we start getting a mix of Iraqi police. Now, these dead Iraqi policemen were all in uniform, and their vehicles, their vehicles were marked with police emblems. So it was a friendly fire incident in the worst way. These guys were not undercover.
And it also went on for over an hour. I mean, it's not – and during the incident, the police were shouting at all times in Arabic and English, "We are police." I mean,
they did not fire a single shot at the U.S. troops. Reporters on the scene found only shell casings from U.S. weapons and none from AK-47s, which the Iraqi police carry. In addition, Jordanian security guards that were guarding a nearby hospital, which was also being used to house people who were displaced by the car bombing of the Jordanian embassy, had opened fire at the U.S. troops because they were being shot at, and the Iraqi police were caught in this horrible crossfire. Now, when you have U.S. troops and Iraqi police and Iraqi militia and Iraqi military, and you have Jordanian guards, and you have Polish troops, and you have troops from a dozen different countries around the world, all operating in the same areas, you're going to have these problems, and the U.S. is not adequately preparing our troops for that problem.
And it's also not, I mean, you have the situation now in that area where villagers and some of the policemen are vowing vengeance on the United States and the United States military for these incidents. It's going to make it much, much more difficult to recruit for these police forces, but to ensure that the police don't then turn around and use their weapons against the U.S.
That's right. And then I just want to wrap up this week in Iraq with USA Today reported on Monday that the cost of occupying Iraq and Afghanistan is at about $5 billion a month and is approaching the same amount that the U.S. spent when we were mired in Vietnam.
For the entire war in Vietnam.
Yes, which averaged about $5.15 billion per month in inflation-adjusted dollars. Meanwhile, the U.S. economy is growing only about half as fast as it was during the Vietnam War, and the federal budget deficit is expected to reach a record $500 billion if Congress approves more money for Iraq.
By the way, on that economy, there was a couple of juxtaposed headlines in the New York Times this morning that I thought were worth drawing attention to, because we talk on this program a lot about the happy talk about the economy. One of the headlines was, I don't have them in front of me, but it was something like, you know, surging U.S. economy exceeds all expectation, you know, very, very much wonderful economy. And then on the other one, you know, workers who lose manufacturing jobs have few options. Now, there's, you know, what purpose is there in an economy other than people making money, you know, making a living? And the fact that so many of these economic indicators are an indicator of wealth, and that wealth is concentrated on very few hands, it's not a measure of whether people are putting food on the table.
That's right.
I was watching, as I regularly do, the media, the news on 6 o'clock on ABC, and I think this was actually a week and a half ago. This wasn't this last week, but they were talking about how bad the economy was and how many jobs are lost and things aren't looking up. But they said there's one booming place that people can always get a job.
Prisons.
Well, that too. They didn't mention that, though.
The military.
It was the funeral industry. They said embalmers are still making better money than ever, and that's what they offered as their solution. To if you're out there and you need a job,
I think
it was incredible.
Death is a big growth industry in this country right now. Yeah.
The choice is suicide or become an embalmer. That's pretty bad, folks.
All right, we just
on that
really
happy
have.
Note.
Well, we have 2 minutes left, a minute of which you're going to use to tell us where we can find.
Yeah,
you
maybe
state.
I can just draw attention to a couple quick stories that people can draw. One is the whole decision of the Israeli government to exile or kill Yasser Arafat, which for the present terms is strictly symbolic, but it's certainly going to do nothing to do anything but inflame the situation in the Middle East. And something that wasn't included in the press accounts in this country, that it shows just how much of a farce the President Bush's roadmap to peace is considered to be in the Middle East itself. That's one. Another was the decision by the Electoral Commission in Venezuela to reject a petition for a referendum that was backed by business leaders there and backed directly by the U.S. government in Washington, D.C., which is still trying to find ways, legal and otherwise, to unseat Hugo Chavez there. In this case, they had literally the ambassador and the people in the U.S. delegation there had actually gone and met with the Electoral Commission to provide technical consulting services in the week before they came to their decision, but they came to a unanimous decision anyway to reject the referendums. And then last but not least, we have the UN decision to give a deadline to the government of Iran for revealing details of its nuclear weapons program. And that, again, is something that's going to be with us in the future, because that is certainly perceived in the Arab world and much of the rest of the world as part of UN and Bush administration designs on the Middle East.
Well, not to worry there, because we have our former Iran-Contra people fixing that for us.
Yeah, we do. And they have a certain amount of expertise about Iran.
They do.
They do.
Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors of Eat the State, and quickly tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, and other places around town where you find free periodicals.
Electoral endorsements.
Yes. We can also be found on the web at www.eatthestate.org. That's Eat the State, all one word, .org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, our phone number, our voicemail line is 206-903-9461.
And next Tuesday, vote against Jim Compton early and often.